I wanted to get through to him. The trouble was that I couldn't think of any other way than to pummel him with my fists until he felt the same degree of pain he had caused in me. I hated my brother. No one could stop me. No one but Genet. When she told me about her deal with Rosina, how she had agreed to be circumcised if Rosina said nothing to Hema, Genet hadn't finished what she had to say. Later that first night, she struggled to consciousness to ask something of me. She had made me swear to it.
"Marion," she said, "punish me, but not Shiva. Attack me and cast me away, but leave Shiva alone."
"Why? I can't do that. Why spare him?"
"Marion, I made Shiva do what he did with me that night. I asked him."
Her words were like kidney punches.
"You know how Shiva is different, how he thinks in another way. Believe me, if I hadn't asked him, he would have read his book and I wouldn't be here."
Reluctantly, on that first night, I had given Genet my word that I wouldn't confront Shiva. I did so mainly because that night had looked as if it might well have been her last. I never told Hema what had really happened, leaving her to imagine whatever it was she thought I had done. Why, you might ask, did I keep my word? Why did I not change my mind when I saw that Genet would survive? Why didn't I tell Hema the truth? You see, I'd learned something about myself and about Genet during her battle to stay alive. I'd come so close to losing her, and it helped me understand that, despite everything, I didn't want her to die. I might never forgive her, but I still loved her. When she was discharged from the hospital, I carried Genet from the car to the house. No one objected, and if they had, I would have stood my ground. My unceasing vigil at Genet's bedside had earned a grudging acknowledgement from Hema. She didn't dare deny me. As I carried her daughter into our house through the kitchen, Rosina watched from her doorway. Genet never looked in that direction. It was as if her mother and the room in which she had lived her life no longer existed. Rosina stood there, beseeching with her eyes, pleading for forgiveness. But a child's ability for reprisal is infinite and can last a lifetime. I carried Genet to our old room, Shiva's room, which would now be hers. The plan was that Shiva and I would sleep in Ghosh's old quarters, but separately, he in the living room. Half an hour later, when I went to get Genet's clothes from Rosina's quarters, she had locked herself in and wouldn't answer despite my knocking. I pushed on the wood in anger, and I could tell from the resistance that she'd barricaded the door, or else she was leaning against it. A peculiar silence blanketed the atmosphere. I went to the window. The shutters were bolted, but now, with Almaz helping, I pulled on the flimsy slats till they snapped off. The wardrobe had been used to block the window. I scrambled onto the ledge and tried to shove the wardrobe aside with my hands, but I couldn't. I craned my neck to peer above it. What I saw made me set my back to the window frame, put both feet on the wardrobe, and topple it without a thought to its contents. It hit the ground with a terrific crash, the wood splintering, the mirror shattering, plates smashing. It brought everyone running. I could see clearly now. We all could see. Hema, Ghosh, Shiva were behind me, and even Genet, hearing the commotion, had dragged herself there. There is a mathematical precision to that scene as I remember it, but there are no angles in Kaa's geometry or any other text that quite describe the slant of that neck, and no pill in the pharmacopoeia that might erase the memory. Hanging from a rafter, her head tilted on her spine, her mouth open and the tongue looking as if it had been yanked out of her throat, was Rosina. Chapter 35. one fever from another. The mossy stone walls and the massive gate of Empress Menin School gave it the look of an ancient fortress. In her white socks, light blue blouse, dark blue skirt, and with no headbands, clips, or earrings, Genet was just one of the girls, blending in. Her only adornment was the St. Bridget's cross hanging from her neck. She didn't want to stand out. Her old vivacious self had died along with the corpse we took down from the rafter and buried in Guleli Cemetery. My new ritual was to come on Saturday evenings to see Genet. She was just up the hill from the palace where General Mebratu, with Zimui at his side, took hostages and tried to bring about a new order. Genet could have come home on weekends, but she said missing evoked painful memories. She insisted she was happy at Empress Menin. The Indian teachers were strict, but very good. Sheltered from society and from us, she worked very hard. We entered university together for our pre-medical course, and the following year we entered medical school. Now out of uniform and in regular clothes, her dress and manner remained reserved and subdued. Each time I went to visit Genet in the Mikani Jesus hostel, opposite the university, I'd pray that this would be the day when the locked door to her heart opened, and I might see traces of the old Genet. She was appreciative for the tiffin carrier of food Almaz and Hema sent for her, but the barrier she put up around herself remained. I still loved her. I wished I didn't. We entered the Haile Selassie I School of Medicine in 1974. Only the third class to be admitted. Genet and I were paired as dissection partners on a cadaver, which was fortunate for her. Anyone else would have taken offense at her frequent absences and her failing to carry her load. I didn't think she was lazy. There was no good reason for this. Something was brewing, and for once I had no clue. Our basic science teachers were very good. A mix of British and Swiss professors and a few Ethiopian physicians who graduated from the American University of Beirut and then took postgraduate training in England or America. There was one Indian, our own Ghosh. Ghosh had a title, not assistant professor or associate professor or clinical associate professor, implying an honorary unpaid designation, but professor of medicine and adjunct professor of surgery. I don't think any of us, not even Hema, realized the extent of Ghosh's scholarship during his 28 years in Ethiopia. But Sir Ian Hill, dean of the new medical school, certainly did. Ghosh had 41 published papers and a textbook chapter to his name. An initial interest in sexually transmitted illness had given way to major scholarship on relapsing fever, for which he was the world's expert, because the louse-borne variety of this disease was endemic to Ethiopia, and because no living person had observed the disease as closely. I learned about relapsing fever as a schoolboy when Ali of the souk opposite Missing brought his brother, Salim, to the hospital and asked me to intercede. Salim burned with fever and was delirious. Ghosh said later that Salim's story was typical. He'd arrived in Addis Ababa from his village with his life's belongings in a cloth strung over his shoulder. Ali found his brother a toehold in the seething, swarming docks of the Makato, where, monsoon or not, he hauled sacks off the trucks and into the godowns. At night, he slept cheek by jowl with 10 others in a flop house. In the rainy season, there was little opportunity to wash clothes because they would take days to dry. Salim's living conditions were unfit for humans, but ideal for lice. While scratching his skin, he must have crushed a louse, its blood entering his body through the scratch. Coming from the village, he had no immunity to this urban disease. In casualty, Salim lay on the ground, too weak to sit or stand, semi-conscious. Adam, our one-eyed compounder, bent over the patient, and with one swift move, made the diagnosis. Years later, Ghosh showed me the correspondence he had with the editor of the New England Journal of Medicine, who was about to publish Ghosh's seminal series of cases of relapsing fever. The editor felt Adam's sign was pretentious. Ghosh defended the honor of his uneducated compounder at the risk of not being published in that prestigious journal.
Dear Dr. Giles, in Ethiopia, we classify hernias as below the knee and above the knee, not direct or indirect. It's another order of magnitude, sir. Our casualty room often has as many as 5 patients prostrate on the floor with fever. The clinician asks, is this malaria? Is it typhoid? Or is it relapsing fever? There is no rash to help sort this out. The rose spots of typhoid are invisible in our population. Though I will grant you that typhoid causes a bronchitis and a slow pulse, and people with malaria often have giant spleens. I would be remiss in publishing a paper on relapsing fever without providing the clinician a practical way to make the diagnosis, particularly in settings where blood and serum tests are hard to come by. The clinician has only to grab the patient's thigh, squeeze the quadriceps muscle, squeeze it hard. Patients with relapsing fever will jump up because of the otherwise silent muscle inflammation and tenderness that is part of this disease. Not only is this a good diagnostic sign, but it can raise Lazarus. This sign was first noted by Adam and is deserving of the eponym Adam's sign. I could testify to Adam's sign. Salim yelled and leaped to his feet when Adam mashed. The editor wrote back. He was pleased with all the other revisions, but Adam's sign remained a sticking point. Ghosh held his ground. Dear Dr. Giles, there is a Chvostek sign, a Boas's sign, a Courvoisier's sign, a Kivenki's sign. No limit, it seems, to white men naming things after themselves. Surely the world is ready for an eponym honoring a humble compounder who has seen more relapsing fever with one eye than you or I will ever see with two. Ghosh, working in an obscure African hospital, far from the academic mainstream, had his way. The paper was published in the prestigious journal and no doubt led to his being invited to write a chapter in Harrison's Principles of Internal Medicine, the Bible of senior medical students. Now, here he was, a professor. Hema bought our new professor 2 beautiful pinstriped suits, one black and the other blue. Also, a tweed coat with leather elbow patches, as if to put professor in quotes. The bow tie was his idea. In all things, especially when it cost little and did no harm to others, Ghosh was his own man. The bow tie told the world how pleased he was to be alive and how much he celebrated his profession, which he called my romantic and passionate pursuit. The way Ghosh practiced his profession, the way he lived his life, it was all that. Chapter 36 Prognostic Signs. Life is full of signs. The trick is to know how to read them. Ghosh called this heuristics, a method for solving a problem for which no formula exists.
Red sky in the morning, sailors take warning. Pus somewhere and pus nowhere means pus in the belly. Low platelets in a woman is lupus until proven otherwise. Beware of a man with a glass eye and a big liver.
Across the outpatient department, Ghosh would spot a breathless young woman, her cheeks flushed, contradicting her general pallor.
He'd suspect narrowing of the mitral valve of the heart, though he'd be hard-pressed to explain exactly why. It would make him listen carefully for the soft, rumbling murmur of mitral stenosis, a devilish murmur which, as he said,
"You'll only hear if you know it's there."
And then it was only audible with the bell of the stethoscope lightly applied over the apex of the heart after exercise. I'd developed my own heuristics, my mix of reason, intuition, facial appearance, and scent. These were things not in any book. The army soldier who tried to steal the motorcycle had an odor at the moment of his demise, and so too had Rosina, and the two odors were identical. They spoke of sudden death. But I didn't trust my nose when I should have, when it picked up signals from Ghosh that put my nerves on edge. I wrote it off as being a function of his new job as a professor, a side effect of his new suits and new environment. When I was around him, it was easy to be reassured. He'd always been upbeat, a happy soul. But now he was even more jovial. He'd found his best self. For a man who prided himself on the three L's, loving, learning, and legacy, he'd excelled in all three. On the anniversary of Hema and Ghosh's marriage, I woke myself at 4 a.m. to study. 2 hours later, I walked over from Ghosh's old bungalow to the main house. Shiva had moved back to our boyhood room. It was still dark outside. I planned to creep into Shiva's room to see if a shirt I was missing had been laundered and hung in his closet. I came in as Almaz arrived. I hugged her and then waited as she made the sign of the cross on my forehead and murmured a prayer. Hema was still sleeping. The hallway bathroom door stood open, steam coming out. Ghosh stood in front of the wash basin, a towel around his waist, leaning heavily on the sink. It was early for him. I wondered why he was using this bathroom, so as not to wake Hema. I could hear his labored breathing before I saw him, and, certainly, before he saw me. The effort of bathing had winded him. In his reflection in the mirror, I saw his unguarded self. I saw terrible fatigue. I saw sadness and apprehension. Then he saw me. By the time he'd turned around, the mask of joviality which had fallen into the sink had been slapped back on, not a seam showing. "What's wrong?" I asked. I felt my stomach flutter. The scent was there. It had to be connected to what I just saw.
"Not a thing. Scary, isn't it?"
He paused to take a breath.
"My beautiful wife is sleeping like an angel. My sons make me so proud. Tonight, I'm going to take my wife dancing, and I'll ask her to extend our marriage contract for another year. The only thing wrong is that a sinner like me doesn't deserve such blessings."
Hema came out to the hallway, shaking sleep from her hair. Ghosh flashed me an anxious look. He turned back to the mirror, whistling as he slapped on cologne. His eyes pleaded with me not to alarm Hema. The effort of holding his arms up made his saints come marching in full of staccato notes and pauses. I got my shirt and left. I had an early morning class, an important one, but I followed my instinct, my intuition, my nose. I dressed and then hid myself behind Shiva's tool shed. Soon, the Volkswagen appeared out of the mist, with just Ghosh in it. I followed on foot. I got to casualty in time to see him enter Matron's office. Not only was Matron there at this early hour, she was waiting. I stood there considering what this meant when Adam appeared carrying a bottle of blood. Matron's door opened for him. Adam emerged moments later, empty-handed. He was startled to see me, and he tried to close the door behind him, but I had a foot there. Ghosh was on a lounge chair, his feet up, a pillow behind his head, smiling. Bach's Gloria chorus sounded on Matron's ancient phonograph. Matron bent over his arm, taping the needle that carried blood into his vein in place. They looked up, thinking perhaps it was Adam returning for something. Ghosh's lips moved.
"Son, you know I..."
"Don't bother to lie to me," I said. He looked to Matron as if for a cue. She sighed.
"This is fate, Ghosh. I always thought Marian should know."
I'll never forget the stillness, the hesitation, and a trace of something I'd never before seen on Ghosh's face. Cunning. Then it gave in to resignation and a faraway look. For a moment, I saw the world through his eyes, his intellect, his sweeping vision that took in Hippocrates, Pavlov, Freud, and Marie Curie, the discovery of streptomycin and penicillin, Landsteiner's blood groups, a vision that recalled the septic ward where he wooed Hema, and Theatre 3 where he was the reluctant surgeon. A vision that recapitulated our birth and looked to the future, looked past his life to the end of mine and beyond. And then, and only then, did it settle, gather, and focus on the now, on a moment when the love was so palpable between father and son that the thought that it might end, and this memory be its only legacy, was unacceptable.
All right, Marion, you budding clinician. What do you think it might be?
He loved the Socratic method. Only this time, he was the patient, and it was my heuristic I would invoke. I'd noticed his pallor before, but I'd refused to let it register. Now I remembered that I'd seen bruises on his arms and legs for the past few months, bruises for which he always had explanations. Was it just a week ago he had the paper cut on his finger? It happened in front of my eyes, and it bled for a while. When I saw him a few hours later, the wound was still oozing. How had I managed to dismiss that? I remembered, too, his hours exposed to radiation from the old coot, the ancient X-ray machine which, despite everyone's protests, he'd continued to use until Missing finally got a new machine. The coot was broken apart with hammers and the pieces hauled to the drowning soil. There, it would keep the army man company while making his bones glow. A blood cancer? A leukemia? I said, hating the sound of those ugly words on my lips. Gosh's disease was only born, it only came to life, the moment I named it. And now it couldn't go away. He beamed, turned to Matron, raising his eyebrows.
Can you believe this, Matron? My son, the clinician.
Then his voice lost its ebullience. He spoke in a manner in which pretense had fallen off like leaves after a frost. Whatever happens, Marion, you mustn't let Hema know. I had my slide sent off about 2 years ago through Eli Harris to Dr. Maxwell Wintrobe in Salt Lake City, Utah, USA. He's a fabulous hematologist. I love his textbook. He personally wrote me back. What I have is like an active volcano, rumbling and spitting. Not quite a leukemia, but brewing into one. It's called myeloid metaplasia, he said, pronouncing it carefully as if it were something delicate and exquisitely wrought. Remember the term, Marion. It's an interesting disease. I still have many years left, I'm sure. The only troublesome symptom I have now is anemia. These blood transfusions are my oil changes. I'm going dancing tonight with Hema. It's our big day, you know. I wanted more gumption.
Why won't you let Ma know? Why didn't you let me know?
Ghosh shook his head.
Hema will go crazy. She can't.
Don't look at me that way, my son. I'm not being noble, I promise you.
Then I don't understand.
You didn't know about my diagnosis these last 2 years, did you? If you had known, it would have changed your relationship with me, don't you think?
He grinned and he ruffled my hair.
You know what's given me the greatest pleasure of my life? It's been our bungalow, the normalcy of it, the ordinariness of my waking, Almaz rattling in the kitchen, my work. My classes, my rounds with the senior students. Seeing you and Shiva at dinner, then going to sleep with my wife.
He stopped there, silent for a long time as he thought of Hema.
I want my days to be that way. I don't want everyone to stop being normal. You know what I mean? To have all that ruined.
He smiled.
When things get more severe, if it ever comes to that, I'll tell your ma. I promise.
He looked at me intently.
You'll keep this a secret? Please? It's what you can do for me. A gift, if you like. Give me as many normal days as I can possibly have. And you mustn't tell your brother, either. That might be hardest for you. I know you two have had a rift. But you understand Shiva better than anyone. I know you care enough for him to protect him from this news getting to him prematurely. I gave him my word.
About the next few months, I remember very little, except that Ghosh's wisdom was revealed. It had been a blessing not to know for the last 2 years. Now that I knew, there was no turning back time or erasing that knowledge. It was as if he were back in jail again, and, in a way, so was I. I read everything I could about myeloid metaplasia, how I hated that term which he loved. His bone marrow was quiet when I first learned of his diagnosis, but then the disease became more active. The volcano started rumbling, oozing lava, spitting telltale traces of sulfurous gas when the wind was right. I spent as much time as I could with Ghosh. I wanted every bit of wisdom he could impart to me. All sons should write down every word of what their fathers have to say to them. I tried. Why did it take an illness for me to recognize the value of time with him? It seems we humans never learn. And so we relearn the lesson every generation and then want to write epistles. We proselytize to our friends and shake them by the shoulders and tell them, seize the day. What matters is this moment. Most of us can't go back and make restitution. We can't do a thing about our should-haves and our could-haves. But a few lucky men like Ghosh never have such worries. There was no restitution he needed to make, no moment he failed to seize. Now and then, Ghosh would grin and wink at me across the room. He was teaching me how to die, just as he taught me how to live. Shiva and Hema went about their days ignorant of Ghosh's condition. They were caught up in their own excitement. Shiva had coaxed Hema into a major commitment to treating women with vesiculovaginal fistula, or fistula for short. It wasn't a condition that Hema, or any gynecologic surgeon, relished seeing because it was difficult to cure. Now I can explain why that little girl whom we'd seen when we were young children, the one who came walking up the hill with her father, her head bowed with shame, dribbling urine at every step, carrying about her an unspeakable odor, had such a profound influence on Shiva's life. Unbeknownst to Shiva and me, Hema had operated on her 3 times. The repair broke down the first 2 times, the last one held. We never got to see her leave missing, but we had Hema's word that she was cured and had left happy. The mental scars, though, would never heal. We understood little at the time of what ailed her. It wasn't a subject Hema would speak about to us. But now, Shiva and I knew. In all likelihood, perhaps before she was a teen, the girl was married off to a man who could have been as old as her father. The painful consummation of a marriage, more traumatic if circumcision had left scar tissue at the entrance to the vagina for the husband to batter down, would have terrified her. She may have even been too young to connect this act with becoming pregnant, but soon she was swollen with child. When labor began, the baby's head jammed against her pelvic bones, the pelvic inlet already narrowed by rickets. In a developed country or a big city, she might have had a cesarean section as soon as her contraction started. But in a remote village, without the help of anyone but her mother-in-law, she would suffer for days, her uterus trying to do the impossible, but succeeding only in ramming the baby's head against the bladder and the cervix, crushing those tissues against the unyielding bony pelvis. The baby soon died inside the womb, and the mother's death would follow shortly, most often due to a ruptured uterus or infection and septicemia. It was the rare family who managed to transport the mother to a health center. There, the lifeless fetus could be removed piecemeal by first crushing the skull and then pulling the rest out. During her convalescence from that dreadful labor, the dead and gangrenous tissues inside her birth passage eventually sloughed off, leaving her with a jagged hole between bladder and vagina. Instead of urine passing from bladder to urethra to emerge just under the clitoris and only when she chose to void, the bladder now constantly leaked its contents directly into the vagina and down her legs. She was never dry, her clothes always soaked, and she dribbled all day. The bladder and its urine quickly became infected and foul-smelling. In no time, her labia, her thighs, became wet and macerated and oozed pus. This must have been when her husband cast her off, and her father came to the rescue. Fistulas have been described since antiquity, but it wasn't till 1849 in Montgomery, Alabama, that Dr. Marion Sims, my namesake, first succeeded in repairing a vaginal fistula. His first patients were Anaka, Betsy, and Lucy, three slave women who had been cast out by their families and their owners because of this condition. Sims operated on them, willing subjects, we are told, in an attempt to cure the fistula. Ether had just been discovered but wasn't in widespread use, so his patients were wide awake. Sims closed the gaping hole between bladder and vagina with silk and thought he had cured them. But a week later, he found pinhole openings along the line of his repair through which urine was leaking. He kept trying. He operated on Anaka some 30 times. He learned from each failure, modified his technique until he ultimately got it right. When Hema operated on the girl we'd seen, she used the principles of repair established by Marion Sims. She first put a catheter through the urethra into the bladder to divert the urine away from the fistula to allow the wet, macerated tissues to dry and heal. A week later, Hema operated vaginally, using the bent pewter spoon the Alabama surgeon had fashioned, the Sims speculum, we now call it, which allowed for good exposure and made vaginal surgery possible. She had to carefully dissect out the edges of the fistula, trying to find what had once been discrete layers of bladder lining, bladder wall, then vaginal wall and vaginal lining. Once she had trimmed the edges, she made her repair, layer by layer. Sims, after many failures, had a jeweler fashion a thin silver wire which he used to close the surgical wound. Silver elicited the least inflammatory reaction from the tissues, inflammation being the reason a repair would break down. Hema used chromic catgut. At dinner, a month after I'd learned of Ghosh's blood disorder, Hema shared with us that she and Shiva had operated on 15 successive fistula patients, with not one recurrence. "I owe this to Shiva," she said. "He convinced me to take more time preparing the women for surgery. So now, we admit the patients and feed them eggs, meat, milk, and vitamins for 2 weeks. We treat with antibiotics till the urine is clear and use zinc oxide paste on their thighs and vulva. It was Shiva's idea to deworm them and correct iron deficiency anemia before surgery. We work on strengthening their legs, getting them moving." She looked at Shiva with pride. "I am embarrassed to say he's seen and understood their needs better than I have after all these years. Like the idea of physical therapy." "Can't get them to walk after surgery if they won't walk before," Shiva said. On 4 of their patients, the hole into the bladder was so large, so scarred down and shrunk back, that it was impossible to pull the edges together. In these patients, Hema and Shiva had learned to expose a narrow but thick stake of flesh under the labia and, while keeping it connected at one end to its blood supply, tunnel its free end up and pull it into the vagina and use it as a live patch in the fistula. Matron has a donor who wants to support nothing but fistula surgery, Shiva said. We're getting $1,000 every month. I found it difficult to look at him, let alone congratulate him. I stopped fretting over Gennett. When she failed 2 of the 4 courses the first year and had to repeat both semesters, I was too distracted by Gosha's illness to care. She wasn't having a good time and living it up. Instead, she'd lost her desire, lost sight of her target if she'd ever had one. All it took was 1 week of not studying, missing class, to get impossibly behind, so hectic was the pace of the first year of medical school. Halfway through my 2nd year, I learned that Gennett had again missed a few anatomy lab sessions. I felt obliged to check on her. At Mekani Yesu's hostel, the door to her room was open. Her visitor's back was to me. Neither of them saw me at first. Gennett shared the room with another girl who wasn't there. The tiny room, which had once been so neat, was now cluttered and messy. The room held a bunk bed and a small table for 2. When he was alive, Gennett acted as if Zimui annoyed her. Her brave and loyal father had died in a hail of bullets, and now she had his picture on the ceiling, inches from her face when she lay on the top bunk. Her visitor's coarse features and his gruff manner made him stand out. I knew him as a student firebrand, organizing others for curricular reform or collecting signatures to oust an unpopular warden. But he was Eritrean first, just like Gennett. The liberation of Eritrea was almost certainly his most important cause, but it was the one he'd have to keep secret. He was speaking to Gennett in Tigrinya, but I heard a few English words. Hegemony and proletariat. He stopped in mid-sentence when he sensed me in the doorway. His bovine eyes gave me a look that said, "You will never be one of us." I deliberately spoke to Gennett in Amharic, so her guest would see that I spoke it better than he did. He muttered something to her in Tigrinya and stalked off. "Who are these radical friends of yours, Gennett?"
"What radicals? I'm just hanging around with Eritreans."
"The secret police have informers on this floor," I said. "They'll link you with the Eritrean People's Liberation Front." She shrugged.
"Do you know the EPLF is making great gains, Marion?" "You can't know that. It's not in the Ethiopian Herald, but I doubt you're here to discuss politics."
In the past, I might have been wounded by her manner. "Hema says hello, and Ghosh says he wants to see you for dinner one of these evenings. Gennett, I'm worried about your dissections. There is no one to do your labs for you this year. If you don't show, you'll fail, no matter what."
"Come on, Gennett."
Her face, so interested and animated when the other man was there, had now become sullen.
"Thank you," she said icily.
I wanted badly to tell her that Ghosh was ill, to shake her out of her self-absorption. And yet I sat there feeling the witchcraft of her presence. It kept me coming after her, and it made me tell myself I still loved her, no matter how she acted, even when our lives were so clearly drifting apart. In my final year of medical school, during my surgery rotations, Ghosh's volcano erupted. I came home to a look on Hema's face that told me she knew. I steeled myself for her tirade. She hugged me instead. Ghosh had thrown up blood and also developed a major nosebleed. He tried to conceal it, but failed. He was resting comfortably in the bedroom. I peeked in on him, then came out and sat with Hema at the dining table. Almaz, red-eyed, brought me tea.
"I suppose I'm glad he didn't tell me," Hema said.
I could see from her swollen eyelids that she'd spent the afternoon crying.
"Particularly when there's nothing to do for it. I've been able to enjoy the best of him. Such perfect days without knowing any of this."
She fingered the diamond ring on her finger, a present that he'd given her the last time they renewed their yearly vows.
"Had I known, maybe we could have taken a trip to America. I asked him about that. He said he preferred to be here. The first sight of me every morning is all he wants. Ayo, he is such a romantic chap, even now. It's funny, but a few months ago, I actually felt that things were so good that something bad had to happen. The signs were all in front of me, but I wasn't paying attention.
Me too, I said. I found Almaz weeping in the kitchen, and Gibru, tears in his eyes, his tiny Bible in his hand, rocking and reciting verses to console her. When they saw me, Gibru said,
"We shall fast for him. Our prayers have been lacking."
Almaz nodded, and though she let me hug her and tried to reassure her, she was agitated.
"We have not been prayerful," she said. "That is why such a thing comes on us."
I asked Gibru if he'd seen Shiva, and he said Shiva had been gone all day, but if he was back, he might be in his bookshop. Gibru walked down with me to the tool shed.
"Are you still wearing your scroll?"
Gibru asked, referring to the thin strip of sheep's hide on which he'd drawn an eye, an eight-pointed star, a ring, and a queen, and copied a verse in fine script. He had rolled the scroll tight and eased it into an empty bullet casing. On the metal, he scratched out a cross and my name.
"Yes, it's always with me," I said,
which was sort of true because I carried this phylactery in my briefcase.
"I should have made one for Dr. Ghosh, and perhaps this would not happen."
I marveled at my faithful friend. To become a priest in Ethiopia, it was enough for the archbishop in Addis Ababa to blow his breath into a cloth bag, which was then carried to the provinces and opened in a churchyard, allowing for the mass ordination of hundreds. The more priests, the merrier, from the standpoint of the Ethiopian Orthodox Church. But having thousands and thousands of priests had its problems for God-fearing people like Almaz. A small number of these men were drunkards and cadgers for whom priesthood was a means of avoiding starvation while satisfying their other appetites. The worst reprobate priest who held out his cross obliged Almaz to stop and kiss its four points. I met her one day looking distressed, her clothes in disarray. She told me she'd beaten off a priest's advances with her umbrella, and others had come to her assistance and pummeled the man.
"Marian, when I'm dying, go to the Mercato and get me two priests," she said to me then. "That way, just like Christ, I can die with a thief on either side of me."
But Gibru was different. Almaz was sure God approved of Gibru. He spent hours with his nose buried in his prayer books, leaning on his makaturia, his praying stick, beads clicking through his fingers. Even when he shed his priest garb to cut the grass, to run errands, to be Missing's watchman and gatekeeper, his turban stayed on and his lips never stopped moving.
"Please make Ghosh a scroll," I said to Gibru. "Have faith. Maybe it's not too late."
Shiva had just come back. I hadn't been in that tool shed for ages, and I was unprepared for the extreme clutter. Parts of engines and electrical boxes covered the floor. The narrowest of paths led to where his tank and welding equipment stood, along with scraps of metal. Shiva had shored up the walls and ceiling of the shed with a welded metal scaffold, and from this his tools hung on wire holsters. He was hidden at his desk behind a mountain of books and papers. I made my way there. He was sketching a design for a frame of some kind, an apparatus he said would allow better exposure during fistula surgery. He put his pencil down and waited. He'd known nothing about what had transpired in the bungalow earlier. I told him the truth about Ghosh. He listened, but said nothing. Though he turned a little pale, his face otherwise gave away very little. He closed his eyes. He had climbed into his treehouse and pulled up the ladder. He had no questions. I waited. Not even this news could break down the walls between us, I saw. I needed him. I had carried Ghosh's secret alone, and now I was ready to spread the burden. I needed his strength for the days that were to come, but I didn't want to admit it. What was Shiva thinking? Did he feel anything at all? I left after a while, disgusted that those eyes would not open, convinced I couldn't count on him. But Shiva surprised me. That night, and for two more nights, Shiva slept in the corridor outside Ghosh and Hema's bedroom, with just a blanket wrapped under and over him. It was his way of expressing his love for Ghosh, of staying close. Ghosh was moved to tears seeing Shiva curled up there the next morning. I felt something around my heart break down and shatter when Hema told me. On the fourth night, as Ghosh's condition worsened, I decided to leave Ghosh's old bungalow and return to the bed I used to share with Shiva. I convinced Shiva not to sleep on the floor in the corridor. We slept awkwardly, on the edges of the mattress, getting up several times in the night to check on Ghosh. By morning, our heads were touching. Shiva and I had the same blood group as Ghosh. With Adam's help, I'd been stockpiling my blood for this moment. Now, Shiva gave his. But blood was no longer sufficient, and it had caused a dangerous iron overload. Ghosh's platelets weren't working. He was oozing from his gums as well as losing blood in his bowel. He became progressively weaker. Ghosh didn't want to move to the hospital. Soon the anemia left him short of breath, and he could no longer lie flat. We moved him from his marital bed of more than 20 years to his favorite armchair in the living room, his legs up on the footstool. Quietly, systematically, he sought time with everyone he loved. He sent for Babu, Adid, Evangeline, and Mrs. Reddy and the other bridge players. I heard them laughing and reminiscing, though it wasn't all laughter. His cricket team surprised him when they arrived dressed in their whites to honor their captain. They regaled him with exaggerated stories of his past exploits. Then it reached the point that he was breathing oxygen through a face mask that sat loosely over his chin. It was my turn to have the conversation with Ghosh. I'd been dreading the moment, resisting its implication.
"You're avoiding me, Marian," he said. "We must start. We can't finish unless we start, right?"
I would never have predicted what he'd say next.
"I don't want you to feel responsible for the entire family. Hema is very capable. Matron, even though she is getting old, is tough and resourceful. I'm saying this to you because I want you to take your medical career to great heights. Don't feel bound by duty to Shiva or Hema or Matron to stay here. Or to Genet," he added, frowning slightly as he mentioned her name. He leaned forward to grab my hand to make sure I understood how serious he was. "I wanted to go to America so badly. All these years I've read Harrison's and the other textbooks. And the things they do, the tests they order. It's like reading fiction, you know? Money's no object. A menu without prices. But if you get there, it won't be fiction. It'll be true." His eyes turned dreamy as he imagined what it was like.
"We stopped you from going, didn't we? Me and Shiva? Our birth?"
"Don't be silly. Can you imagine me giving up this?" he said, sweeping his hand to indicate family, missing, the home he'd made out of a bungalow. "I've been blessed. My genius was to know long ago that money alone wouldn't make me happy. Or maybe that's my excuse for not leaving you a huge fortune. I certainly could have made more money if that had been my goal. But one thing I won't have is regrets. My VIP patients often regret so many things on their deathbeds. They regret the bitterness they leave in people's hearts. They realize that no money, no church service, no eulogy, no funeral procession, no matter how elaborate,
can remove the legacy of a mean spirit.
Of course, you and I have seen countless deaths among the poor. Their only regret, surely, is being born poor, suffering from birth to death. You know, in the book of Job, Job says to God, "You should have taken me straight from the womb to the tomb. Why the in-between part? Why life, if it was just to suffer?" Something like that. For the poor, death is at least the end of suffering. He laughed as if he liked what he just said. His fingers automatically went up to his pajama pocket, then to the back of his ear, searching for a pen, because the old gauche would have jotted that down. But there was no pen, and no more need to write anything down. "I haven't suffered. Well, maybe briefly. Only when my darling Hema made me pursue her for years. That was suffering." The smile said it was a kind of suffering he wouldn't have traded for fame or fortune. "Shiva will thrive with Hema. Hema needs him to keep her occupied. Hema's instinct will be to retreat to India. She'll make a lot of noise about that. It won't happen. Shiva will refuse. So she'll stay here in Addis. What I am saying is that it's not your worry. You understand?" I nodded, without much conviction. "I do have one small regret," Ghosh said. "But it's something you can help me with. It has to do with your father." "You're the only father I've ever had," I said quickly. "I wish Thomas Stone had this leukemia instead of you. I wouldn't care one bit if he died." He waited before answering, swallowing hard. "Marian, it means everything to me that you consider me your father. I couldn't be prouder of you, of who you've become. But I bring up Thomas Stone for selfish reasons. As I said, it's one of my regrets. You see, I was as close a friend to your father as he was capable of having. You have to picture how it was then, Marian. He was the only other male physician here at Missing. We were so different. Nothing in common, or so I thought when I met him. But I found that he loved medicine in the same sort of way that I love medicine. He was dedicated. His passion for medicine, it was as if he came from another planet. My planet. We had a special bond." His eyes drifted off to the window, perhaps recalling those times. I waited. Eventually, he turned to me and squeezed my hand. "Marian, your father was deeply wounded by something. God knows what. His parents died when he was a child. We never talked about things like that. But here, working alongside Sister Mary Joseph Praise, all of us working together, he was sheltered. He was as happy as such a man can be. I felt protective of him. He knew surgery well, but he had no understanding of life." "You mean he was like Shiva?"
He paused to consider this.
"No. Very different. Shiva's content. Look at him. Shiva has no need for friendship or social support or approval. Shiva lives in this moment. Thomas Stone wasn't like that. He had all the needs the rest of us have. But he was scared. He denied himself his needs. And he denied himself his past."
"Scared of what?"
I found all this hard to swallow. "Matron told me once that he threw instruments when he got upset. She said he had a temper, that he was fearless."
"Oh, fearless in surgery, I suppose. But even that might not be true. A good surgeon must be fearful. And he was a good surgeon. The best, never foolhardy, and appropriately fearful. Well,
a few lapses of judgment. But then he was human. But when it came to relationships, he was terrified. He was frightened that if he got close to anyone, they'd hurt him. Or perhaps he'd hurt them. I was resisting this construction of stone that was so different from what I'd made up all these years. Finally, I asked, "What do you want from me?" "Now that my time is coming, Marian, I want to let Thomas Stone know that whatever happened, I always considered myself his friend." "Why don't you write to him?" "I can't. I never could. Hema hasn't forgiven him for leaving. She was happy he left. She wanted you too from the moment you were born. But still, she wouldn't forgive him for leaving. And then, once he left, she was terrified, always, that he might come back and claim you. I had to promise her, swear to her, that I wouldn't write him or communicate with him in any form." He looked at me and said with quiet pride, "I kept my word, Marian." "Good. I'm glad." I'd harbored such curiosity about Thomas Stone when I was younger. I had fantasized about his return. Now I resisted Ghosh, and I wasn't quite sure why. Ghosh went on, "But I fully expected Stone to contact me. I was disappointed as the years went on that he didn't. Marian, he is filled with shame, and he assumes that I have no desire to see him, that I hate him." "How do you know?" "I've no way of knowing this for sure. I suspect that to this day he sees himself as an albatross. Call it clinical intuition, if you like. The truth is that you are better off with us than with him. Try as he might, I don't know that he could have created what we have here, a family. So I don't want you to hate that man. The cross he carries is huge." "Why tell me this now?" I said. "I stopped thinking about him after you came out from jail. He was never there when we needed him. Why should I waste my time thinking about him?" "For my sake. I told you this is for me. My one regret. It's not about you. But only you can help me." I said nothing. "Let me see if I can explain." He looked up at the ceiling for a few seconds. "Marian, there'll be something incomplete about my life if I don't let him know that I still consider him a brother." His eyes became wet. "And that whatever his reasons are for being silent all these years, I still love him. I can't see him. I can't tell him this. But you can. I won't live to see it, but that's what I want. Do it without hurting Hema's feelings. Do it for me. Complete what is incomplete." "Are you going to tell Shiva this?" "If I tell Shiva that it's my dying wish, he'd do it. But Shiva may not know how to do it. How to heal him. It requires more than delivering a message." He hesitated. "Speaking of Shiva, what I also need to tell you about Shiva is that whatever he did to you, please forgive him." He stunned me there. Had he planned to say that? Was it an afterthought? I didn't think Ghosh knew the depths of my hurt, my bitterness toward Shiva, but I'd underestimated him. Still, what happened between me and Shiva wasn't a subject I wanted to bring up with Ghosh. It was too painful, too personal. "I'll do my best about Thomas Stone. For you. But I can't believe this is what you want. You're forgetting this is the man who caused my mother's death. A nun's death. A nun, he got pregnant, and then he abandoned his children.
and to this day, no one seems to know how any of it happened.
As my voice rose and quavered, Ghosh said nothing, but looked at me steadily till my shoulders collapsed